Hello, everybody, and welcome to the You Should Run podcast. I'm Tony Heil, council member in Bridgeport, PA. And if you've listened to the podcast, which I hope you have, you know I've talked with guests from every state, from Maine to Hawaii and Alaska to Florida, from school board and borough council to U.S. Senate and Congress and all points, well, maybe not all points, but most points in between. There are 500,000 elected offices in this country, and in my opinion, the most important offices are actually state legislatures. That's where the best things are happening. So that's also where the worst things are happening. And one of my guests today is going to talk about what's happening, good and bad, maybe more bad than good. We'll see. In North Carolina, that's where I have some family there. We'll see if I should be worried for them or hopeful for them. Her name is Representative Julie Von Hafen. Julie, thanks for talking today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
So I've been following you for a bit. You are not shy about your activities. You make sure to bring people together. So my question I always ask people is, have you always been politically engaged, or did something in particular get you to become more than just someone who votes or watches the news?
Yeah, I mean, I think going back even to high school, politics was something I was really interested in. I actually went to college to become a journalist, and I wanted to write about politics. I was a journalism major. And I've always also just been an advocate, I think. Like I said, starting in high school, you know, I was writing letters to the editor about things in my community I was not happy about. And so I think running for office was kind of a natural extension of that. I ended up not being a political writer, but I ended up going to law school and, you know, using my writing skills there. And then after I was a lawyer for about a decade, I ended up getting married and having three kids and stayed home with them for a while. And while I was staying home with them, I got really involved with PTA. And mm-hmm. I always tell the story that I wasn't the typical PTA mom. I was not baking cookies. I was going to school board meetings and advocating for our local school district and our schools, both where I live in Raleigh, North Carolina, and then became a member of our state board of state PTA board. And so I was advocating, you know, in Congress for North Carolina schools. And I think, you know, education is really the issue that led me to run for office. But there's lots of other issues I care about. But I think that's the number one thing because of the work that I was doing at the time.
It seems like in North Carolina, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that education has been a top priority for a while. It's something kind of for some a lot of people to be proud of, both the school system and the university system. My sister-in-law works for Duke. She's very proud of like what they can do at Duke, UNC, and other places. And the people who leave there are very proud of their education. But when you talk about someone being involved in the PTA in 2023 or 2024, it's a lot different from when you were there, right? Like, did something change, or are we just not been paying attention? We being everyone, other people.
Yeah, unfortunately, I mean, I think when I was involved with PTA, which was, you know, my oldest is now 19. So, you know, I mean, I've really been in the schools for almost 20 years now since my oldest started in the public schools here in our area. I mean, you know, when I was first involved, I think the main thing is, you know, just trying to get parents to be more involved in their kids' schools and their educational opportunities and what's going on in their classrooms. And it's funny because when I hear now, especially, you know, post-Trump, post-COVID, you know, I think the pandemic, from what I saw, like, has really changed the way that parents are interacting with school districts and school board mm-hmm. meetings now. I mean, what we've seen is, you know, during the masking and the shutdown of schools, you know, just this incredible backlash by parents against, you know, what's going on in schools. And it's really sad because I hear, oh, parents need to be more involved and the schools are keeping them out. And that's just incredibly not my experience. I mean, when I was there, we were begging, you know, for people to come in and volunteer and be involved and know what the teachers were doing. So this whole narrative that, you know, teachers are doing things in secret or trying to keep parents out of the classroom is just absolutely not true. And unfortunately, what we've seen is, you know, this backlash against public education. I mean, we've seen it, you know, really under the magnifying glass here in North Carolina, but it's really a national trend, you know, that we're seeing across the states. But, and like you said, North Carolina used to be a leader in education, whether it was early education, whether it was our incredible university system. And it's really sad how much we backslid over the last decade or so.
Yeah, you know, for me, when we had our kids home for a bit and I was seeing what they were doing, I became more of a fan of public education because I saw all the hard work, saw like when people talk about kids reading at a third grade level now, it's not so much about that they read at a third grade. What a third grade level is also different from when you and I went to school, right? Like you've been paying attention. I think that people who don't have kids in school don't understand just how much schools themselves have advanced in the last few decades.
Yeah, I mean, even when my kids were in school, you know, this change and, you know, kind of learning the, you know, the arithmetic tables or cursive, you know, is now changed to what in North Carolina in my kids' school district, you know, they talk about the four C's, which are like collaboration, critical thinking, creativity, communication, you know, that they're really focused on creating students that are prepared for a modern workplace, not, you know, going back to like the hearkening of like the 50s, you know, but unfortunately, like this backlash is people who want to go back to the 50s and kind of have these segregated schools that are kind of producing these, you know, certain types of kids. And what I see in our public schools is just the incredible creativity and collaboration that teachers have with each other and how they're creating that in their students. And, you know, I wish that more people would actually go in the classrooms and see what's going on rather than kind of judging it from afar, which is really what I see happening.
So when you got to the legislature, even when you were campaigning, what did you see in terms of why the state legislatures are so important when it comes to education? Because I think you said you advocated in Congress or, you know, about federal issues. People often think just about their school board. But for regular folks, why are state legislatures so important on that?
I mean, when it comes to education in North Carolina, I'm sure this is true in every state. I mean, the public education system gets the bulk of the amount of money in our state budget every year. You know, it gets almost 60% of our budget. And, you know, we are the one governmental entity that controls every district in the state. We're controlling, you know, the curriculum. We're controlling, in North Carolina, we control the school calendar at the state level. Wow. We control teacher pay, you know, teacher licensure. I mean, we touch every single part of education in our state. And, you know, when I was doing them on the advocacy side, you know, from the PTA side, we were going to the state legislature and talking to, you know, our state representatives. And it's funny because one of the big pushes that really led me probably to run for the state house was a bill that was passed in 2017 that we really rallied parents around all over the state because it was going to cut art, music, and PE classes. And I tell you, don't take your anybody's art or music class away because it really galvanized parents. And it really, I think it made a lot of people realize what the state legislature does, you know, in a bad way because they didn't even realize that they could do that. But, you know, the state legislature is really where it's all at when it comes to education, because we really also affect a lot of local policies, especially here in our state, because we have a very strong state government. We are a Dillon Roll state, which I'm sure you know as a local official, you know, that means we basically have say over what any local municipality can do, and that includes school districts.
So when you got to the state legislature, you had experience in advocating for education. You know, you weren't coming at this without any knowledge. You know, you had your own experience. But as you talk to your colleagues, both that you agree with and on the other side of those issues, what's the pushback? Like, do you think that it's genuine or is it just an ignorance? And I don't mean stupidity. I just mean I'm ignorant of a lot of things. I'm not that it doesn't mean it's smart. But, you know, why do you think there is this pushback from the other side? Is it because of the money they're getting for private schools and vouchers, or is it because they just they don't have kids in the school district, so they don't realize it? Or what do you think is kind of driving those problems?
I think it's a combination of things. I think, yes, one, we don't have enough people, you know, at least in our state legislature, that have kids in school right now. You know, a lot of our members are older. Maybe they haven't been in a school for quite a long time. But I do think, you know, it all started back when Republicans took over our state legislatures back in 2011. And, you know, it's just been this decade plus long movement to privatize education, and privatize a lot of things. It's not just education, mm-hmm. but, you know, this movement that started with just chipping away gradually at different things around the edges that they could do around public education. And now it's kind of culminated in this private school voucher program that we're seeing being expanded in most red states in our country. And it's just, you know, this move to the narrative that, you know, we need to have what's best for all children, which of course nobody can disagree with that. But unfortunately, all children don't have the opportunity to go to a private school. And, you know, that's why it's so upsetting to me, because as somebody who I feel, you know, champions equity, private schools are kind of the opposite of equitable education. And so it's really upsetting to me. And I think it just, it goes back to this whole wanting to go back to, you know, a lifestyle of yesteryear, whether it's like the education system of the 50s or Make America Great Again, you know, just this pushback on diversity and new ways of thinking, new collaboration, new creativity that we're seeing in schools. And it's just been a years, decades long process that is really kind of coming to a head right now.
Yeah. And sadly, North Carolina was in the news about, you know, you had your colleague that switched parties, and really anyone outside of North Carolina, along with you, was kind of grossed out by that whole, how that all played out and to benefit school vouchers. But you know, you talk about the equity issue. It does cut against everyone's education. So it's kind of equitably bad in a way, right, when it comes to school vouchers, because even if, you know, your kids are in a good school district, everyone kind of gets hurt when there's a huge cut that's going through the voucher system, right? So what's, for people who don't know, what does that kind of, what negative thing does that mean? Like, why are the vouchers bad? Because I think a lot of people think, all right, well, my kid's in a school that's not so good, they can go to a better school. That seems like a pretty simple answer, but the realities are more complex.
Yeah, a lot more complex. I mean, one, you know, you just have to remember that any money that's going to this program has to be taken away from something else. Right. And, you know, we've done a lot of calculations to figure out that if the voucher program is used to the extent that it can be, you know, it's going to take millions of dollars away from every single district in the state. So, you know, for all the kids that are left behind, you know, back in the traditional public schools, you know, they're going to be hurt because of a lack of funding again. But I'd say that a lot of people don't even realize that even if you go to a private school and you do take advantage of these vouchers, most of the time they don't pay for the entire tuition.
That's the thing, right?
You know, the tuitions are, you know, $20,000-$30,000 a year, you know, and these vouchers range, you know, from say $3,000 to maybe $5,000. So, you know, it's not like you're getting a free ride to these schools. And so that really cuts into the whole idea that they're open to everyone, because they're not. You know, the one big thing and that we've been really pushing on is how these schools, you know, discriminate against kids with special needs, against, you know, people are shocked to know that, you know, if you don't subscribe to their, say, like profession of faith or something, you know, that you mm-hmm. have to literally sign something that says you know, agree with everything that they profess religious, you know, affiliation, you know, you're not allowed to go there. Or if you have two moms or two dads, you're not allowed to go there, you know. So what really burns me about it is how, you know, we're using taxpayer money for these schools that can discriminate. And also most of them are very religiously based. And of course, I don't agree with using public money for religious affiliated organization. So yeah, there's just lots of things that are not good about it. And what's so frustrating is that here in North Carolina, you know, we have a constitutional duty to our children to provide, you know, a sound basic education. It's in our state constitution, and our state courts have said we're not doing that. We've been in violation of our constitution for almost three decades at this point, but they continue to refuse to fund them and to put, you know, $500 million into this private school voucher scheme. So it's not a good situation.
Right. So instead of it helping people to get out of bad schools, if they're at bad schools anyway, because I think that's a really bad thing to say. From my experience, you see some schools that quote-unquote perform not as well, and you realize that you're comparing apples to bananas a lot of the time. They're not even apples to bananas. But you're really just giving someone who's got an $80,000 scholarship, I mean $80,000 tuition, $10,000 off. So it doesn't help anyone. It doesn't have the other $70,000.
Right, yeah, I mean, like 85 to 90% of kids in North Carolina go to our public schools. So, you know, in my opinion, that's where we should be putting our efforts and our money and all these other things into making sure that we're providing that education to the majority of kids that live in our state.
Well, one thing that I know a majority of North Carolina voters want, including every other state almost, is to protect women's rights and protect abortion access, which you've been very vocal about, and I'm glad you're being vocal about it, because, you know, otherwise it gets passed over. You got elected in 2018. The issues were a lot different in 2018 because of the Supreme Court at the time. Were you prepared when the Supreme Court did what they did with Dobbs? Did you know, like, we have got to be prepared for this?
Well, when I came in the legislature, like you said, I was elected in 2018. There were members, you know, in our legislature that were doing this work, but my goal was to really bring the issue to the forefront, because my understanding and, you know, my learning about more about abortion rights and what was going to be happening after Trump was elected was, you know, everyone was waving the red flag, like, this is going to happen, you know, we need to be prepared. And so, you know, my first session, I think I filed, you know, a very proactive bill to protect abortion in North Carolina, or expand abortion rights in North Carolina. And I mean, knowing that under the Republican majority, it wasn't going to get passed, but I wanted to just start the conversation and be on the offense on this issue, because mm-hmm. we're constantly on the defense. So in, you know, and then when I was reelected in 2020, you know, with Biden being elected at the time, you know, we were hopeful, but unfortunately the Supreme Court had changed at that point. And so, you know, it was really, I think that I was prepared because of my work with the abortion organizations and reproductive rights organizations, because they knew, you know, for many, many years that this was going to happen. And they, like I said, they kept trying to warn people. But, you know, it's really upsetting that we didn't take more action, both nationally and in some of the states that we could have, you know, in preparation for Dobbs happening.
And since you've been working on the issue and you've talked with a lot of experts, including your colleagues, what do you think regular people need to know? Maybe even men. Like, I very much support abortion rights. I watched my wife give birth twice, and I'm glad it was, you know, we were able to do that in a good, healthy way. But I know how traumatic that is, just from a safe and good pregnancy where it's wanted. You know, I'm glad. So what do you think people need to know about what has transpired since then? Because it's more complicated than just abortion rights are under attack.
Oh, gosh. We have an hour or so?
Well, no. But, like, is there anything, like, people, like, because I think people don't really appreciate, like, the realities of what that means for people, right?
Yeah. I mean, the one thing that I will say that since Dobbs has fallen, and we know, or since Roe has fallen under Dobbs, that every state is so different now when it comes to what mm-hmm. kind of access you can have, right? I mean, and before Dobbs was decided, I went down to Mexico with the State Innovation Exchange and the Women's Equality Center, and we went to learn about abortion access in a country where every state had different laws. And it was exactly what was happening right now in the United States. And we went there before Dobbs was decided. And when it was right around the time when the leak happened, so we knew it was coming, you know. But and it's so interesting now looking back on that trip, you know, almost 2 years later, and seeing that the United States is now exactly like what Mexico was 2 years ago, and the fact that you would just go from state to state and every state was so different. And I think that what we're really seeing and the damage that's being caused by that is that people don't know where to go to get care. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't even know what the law is in their own state, much less the state next to them or, you know, the state across, you know, the country. And that's really scary for people. You know, that is really scary when you think about getting pregnant. And if something bad happens, you have to like go to a lawyer to figure out where I can go to get health care. You know, that's the thing that I'm seeing that's probably the most damaging is that, you know, for somebody myself who had three kids, luckily healthy pregnancies, I can't imagine being in a situation where I needed to like go to the doctor or get an abortion because something was going bad with my pregnancy. Or even now, if I got pregnant and I didn't want to have another child, I don't, you know, if I'm just a normal person, I don't know if I can go get that care. And that's really, really difficult. And I think it's so unfair, you know, to half the population in this country to put us in that kind of situation. And I think that I also wanted to add that I think it's really unfair for doctors who have gone to medical school to provide health care to people who now have to navigate like a legal system and be experts on the law when that's not why they went to school. They didn't go to school to become lawyers or police officers or judges. They went to be a doctor, and that's what they should be doing. And what I've been hearing from doctors is now they're confused about what the law is. They're confused about what care they can provide. And I think that part of the anti-abortion strategy is to create this confusion and this patchwork of laws where nobody knows what's going on and creating this chaos almost around abortion in our country.
Yeah. Do you think that this affects care beyond abortion even for women and for anyone? Because if you're a doctor who, you know, is an expert in women's health care and abortion care, et cetera, and you feel like, oh, well, I can't do that, then you might be leaving to go to Pennsylvania or Virginia or, you know, Massachusetts or California. Like it seems like it would be unsafe to practice general care in a state where you don't know what you can do.
Absolutely. I've heard that directly from doctors that, you know, even if patients come to them, you know, say they're more advanced in their pregnancy, you know, and then they find out something, you know, is wrong with the baby or, you know, even the mother's health is being affected. The doctors are like, okay, well, what week are you? Like, can I do this? Can I not do this? You know, they're having to go get legal advice from, you know, hospital administrators or, you know, and as a lawyer, I actually used to represent hospitals. So it's like, I know exactly, mm-hmm. you know, those lawyers that work for the hospitals are having to navigate all of this too. And it just, it's so sad that like, they have to even think about those things. They should just be thinking about how they can help their patient, not whether they're going to, you know, get in trouble or get sued or get arrested for whatever health care they're providing. And you're exactly right that, I mean, here in North Carolina, doctors are leaving, you know, and a lot of states that have these restrictive laws, doctors are leaving those states because they want to provide health care. That's why they became doctors, and they don't want to live in a state where they can't do what they were trained to do. I just met a woman who is here in North Carolina for her residency, and she's a family practitioner, but she, you know, wants to do pregnancy care and reproductive health care as well as part of her job. And, you know, I said, are you going to stay here after your residency is over? And she said, no, I'm going to go to Virginia where I can, you know, practice the way I want to practice. And that's just going to create more maternity healthcare deserts and other things, you know, here in our state. And I've heard that that's happening in all kinds of, in all the restrictive states really in the country. So
it's really heartbreaking. And I feel like, you know these people more better than I do from your work, but I feel like a lot of it comes down to how a lot of conservatives and Republicans campaign with such simplicity. Like you see the IVF issue in Arkansas, where Arkansas, and they talk about, well, life begins at conception, and as a result, they can't do IVF. When you make things sound so simple, where, well, yeah, that sounds right, suddenly you end up in these situations that you can't really you can't fix.
Yeah, I mean, that's why this whole idea of like fetal personhood or life beginning at conception, it doesn't just affect abortion. Like, now we're seeing it affect IVF. It can affect contraception access, because if, life begins at conception, then preventing conception, technically, they would argue that, like, that's why birth control is bad or illegal. And we've actually seen bills introduced, in other states. I can't remember offhand if we've had one in North Carolina yet, but I know like Oklahoma, I think this session, this year, they had a really big bill introduced by a Republican, banning, all these things, contraception, IVF, abortion, everything. And so it's really, really scary. And like when Democrats talk about, they're coming for your contraception next, people think we're being, it's just hyperbole and we're, being too dramatic, but unfortunately, I don't think that's the case. And it is really scary.
So a couple of quick questions here. One, you are in the minority in North Carolina. You want to kind of break that minority as much as you can in the next election. Maybe these issues will help, but how do you, when you go to campaign, how do you measure success? Like at a regular job, I'll go in and say, oh, I brought in another $100,000 in sponsorships or sales or whatever. But, when you are campaigning and you can't say that you are the majority in the legislature, how do you go and measure your own success, either politically or personally?
That's a great question. I mean, you see people attack Democrats like, well, they didn't get one bill passed. Well, I mean, that's not really my fault. Right. I file many, many, many bills, and all of them pretty much go in the trash can, so to speak. They get referred to the Rules Committee, which in here in North Carolina basically means they're never going to be seen or heard from again. And so it's really frustrating to be criticized in that way, because I have no control over what types of bills, get heard or get passed. So
yeah, imagine if you posted a bill that said, I like it when it's sunny and 75 degrees. They would say, well, it came from Democrat Julie John Von Haven, so we're going to trash that.
Absolutely. I mean, I file bipartisan bills. I get Republicans on some of my bills, and they still don't pass. So, it's not like they're just all my ideas, and I don't have any kind of bipartisan support for them. For me, somebody asked me that the other day, like, what would be success to you at the end of a legislative session? And I always just say, for me personally, success is that I want to go back. Because it's really, really difficult to serve in the super minority. We're in the super minority. Right. So that's even more difficult than being just in the simple minority. So if I want to go back and I want to return, to the legislature year after year, I feel like that's success to me, because it would be a lot easier just to pack up and go home. Honestly, I mean, this is really difficult work. And I think that people don't realize kind of the mental toll it takes on you, some of the physical toll, the familial toll, it's hard, kind of beating your head against the wall every day and saying, can I go back and have more of it?
Yeah.
So I feel like my success to me is that I want to keep fighting. Then I want to keep go back there. I want to keep using my voice as much as I can. And I think that my constituents, like, even though they know I am in the super minority and they don't expect me to, pass any sweeping, education bill or abortion bill, because they know my reality, I think they've been happy with my representation of them, because I use my voice, and I'm using my voice to stand up for the things that they care about. And also, I value my constituent services. Like, I really try to stay in touch with my community. I'm always out and about, you know, in the district, and I, you know, do lots of office hours and town halls. And I think just for my constituents, like, they want to just see that I'm working as hard as I can for them, whether that means I'm passing legislation, maybe is not as important as if as, that I'm just standing up for the issues that they care about.
So one question that I ask a lot of my guests now, especially since my U.S. Senator John Fetterman has made such a big deal about mental health, you know, you care personally about these bills. You know the good thing that can happen if they pass, and you know the bad things that can happen if other things pass or your bills fail. What do you do to protect your own mental health? And for people who are running for office or just activists because they care a lot, what's your recommendation for caring about your mental health and things that you can do in that manner?
Well, one, I would say that, you know, like you said at the beginning, I am pretty active on social media. And unfortunately, social media comes with a lot of trolls and, you know, people that will harm your mental health, to be honest. And it's taken me a while to kind of, you know, balance that. I think that, you know, I tend to mute a lot of people that, you know, that I don't really, you know, that really all they're on there to do is criticize you and to call you names and criticize your person, you know, your who you are, your personality, your looks, you know, anything that they can do to like make you feel, you know, like worse than you are is really important. And I think that the one thing that people have to really do is really prioritize rest and self-care. And I know self-care kind of gets this whole, you know, oh, that means you go get, you know, pedicure or, you know, massage. But no, that's not what self-care is to me. It's taking 5 minutes to like walk outside while you're in session and just get some sunshine on your face and like take a deep breath. You know, it's maybe taking an hour to spend time with your kids. It's, you know, taking a weekend off to go up to the mountains, which I like to do, and just kind of getting physically away from the situation. I think that, you know, our society and our culture does not prioritize and does not value self-care and rest. And I think that as elected officials, we have to literally schedule it sometimes into our day or into our schedule, or else we won't do it. And I've really tried to do that more and just really like protect that time and really prioritize it in my own life, because we're not good to anyone if we're burned out and we're, you know, feeling negative and we're feeling horrible about everything. So you just have to protect that time and make sure, and that counts for advocates, it counts for anybody, because this is really difficult work and it's really, really easy to burn out. And so we have to prioritize rest for sure.
And if your self-care is getting a pedicure, that's okay as well. It doesn't matter what you're doing. If you have to, sometimes you have to like watch a dumb movie or read comic books or, you know, whatever it is, but you have to step away from it. Sometimes you're just going to get burned out way too quick.
Yes, absolutely. Do what makes you feel good.
So just two more questions. One, the podcast is called You Should Run. It's 2024. Filing deadlines are coming up in places, or maybe people are thinking about 2025 and beyond. What would be your words of encouragement for others to run for office, especially electing more women to office?
Absolutely, yes. I think especially for women, and I know that many people talk about this all the time, but I experienced it myself, you know, this whole idea of imposter syndrome. We have to get over, you know, the fact that many people feel like, well, I'm not experienced enough, you know, I'm not smart enough, I don't, you know, have the right background, I don't, you know, have this, I don't have that. And you will be amazed if you're even thinking about running for office, like go and actually observe, you know, whether it's a state legislature, a school board, you know, your town council, whatever you're thinking about running for, go and like sit in on a meeting, because you'll be amazed that like you are just as smart as a lot of people in this room. And it, you know, that's what always amazes me, is that I always thought you had to have some special qualifications or, you know, whatever to do this job. And you know, now that I'm in the legislature, many times I just sit there and I'm like, okay, wow, like there's just a lot of people in this room that, you know, I consider myself, you know, a smart person, and I feel like I have a lot to offer. And I think that many people out there were probably in the same situation that I was. And, you know, you just get over that imposter syndrome, because, you know, we need you. And most of the people in the room probably felt the same way when they first started. But, you know, there's so many people there to help you. There's so many people to mentor you. And, you know, we just need regular people, you know, who are willing to serve and put themselves out there. And I will say that, you know, when I was making the decision to run, I knew I wasn't sure if I was going to win or lose. Like, I was trying to flip a seat, and, you know, it was really challenging and difficult. But I think what made me finally decide to do it is I said to myself, this is going to change your life one way or the other. You know, it's going to change you whether you win or lose. And so if you're looking for a way to kind of step outside your comfort zone, to make a difference, to change the trajectory of your own life, like, running for office will do that. You know, because I saw people who lost their races, but they still went on to do incredible things because of the skills and the people that they met on the way. Mm-hmm. And that there's just really not another experience, I feel like, that can do that. So it's a great experience. It's challenging. It's difficult. It will push you in ways you've never been pushed before. But I think those are all good things.
One last thing that maybe not be so good, or maybe good. I have to ask, because like I said, I have family in North Carolina. I care about North Carolina a lot, even if I've only been there like twice. Is that I think North Carolina is maybe the most important state in the 2024 election. Who knows if it'll flip in terms of a president, but you have a very good candidate for governor and a very, very, maybe the worst candidate in the country for governor as well. In Pennsylvania, we elected an attorney general named Josh to become governor. That was a great idea. Can you explain just quickly why this year's elections are so incredibly vital for North Carolina?
Oh, wow. Yes. North Carolina is going to be one of the, like you said, one of the most important states for Joe Biden to win. He only lost to Trump in 2020 by like 1% or something like that. You know, we have a really important governor's race, like you said. We are trying to, you know, break that supermajority in the legislature, which is obviously something I'm extremely focused on, so that we can hold the governor's veto and hopefully our Democratic governor gets elected. We had a flip in our Supreme Court. So we have, you know, Republican-controlled Supreme Court now, which has been really devastating for election and voting rights as well as education. They've made some really horrible decisions lately on those fronts. And so we're trying to hold a Supreme Court seat, which, you know, hopefully we can flip the Supreme Court in a few years, but we have to hold this seat so we can do that. Just so many important races, and we have an incredibly vivacious and energetic and amazing new state party chair who's 26, and she's gotten some incredible national attention. She's doing some great work around rural organizing, because what we've seen, and I'm sure in many other states, you know, this rural-urban divide has really hurt us. And so she's really trying to, you know, encourage the rural areas to get organized and get out and vote. And so much is going on here. We're ground zero on so many really important races. And I'm excited for this year. I feel like we're going to break the supermajority in the legislature, and hopefully we'll maintain the governor's seat. We'll win the state for Joe Biden, and we're going to do it this year. I'm excited.
Great. And if people are interested, and I hope they are, where should they go to learn more about you? How do they follow you online?
So I'm on all the platforms, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, Threads, and it's all at Julie for NC.
That's great. It's a common name. It's very good that you beat up any other Julies that wanted that, right? Because beforehand, you like made sure no one else, no other Julie could be the 4 NC before you, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Well, thank you, Julie. I really appreciate what you're doing. I wish you the best of luck, not just for you personally, but for the people of North Carolina. And hopefully, if anyone is listening, they'll be encouraged and they'll want to run for office too.
I hope so. Thank you so much.